Blog Talk Radio.
Said he's been so good. God, it's been so good.
Good, it's been good enough. You've been better than good to me.
God, it's had my back in the midst of my enemies, and I ain't even have to be there.
Hello, hello. I'm Verna Thomas Milton, and welcome to the Verna's Health Foundation Metroplex Buzz. Thank you for joining us this evening, and I am so honored to have my special guest. And I know she's on the line, and her name is Mrs. Alma Muscatawala. And Alma, if I'm not pronouncing that right, you're gonna have to tell me how to pronounce your name. Good evening.
No, you did great.
Okay.
You did great, and interestingly enough, you know, my name has a very interesting meaning as well. So you said Alma, but it is actually Almas with an S.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically means diamond in Arabic, and Alma means soul in Spanish. So
Okay. Either
ways, I like the way it has been pronounced, because, you know, it's such valuable meaning in both regards.
Yes. Well, Alma, I am so happy that you had took the time out to be our guest this evening. And you're such a all-about person. You have so much. You've done so much within the Dallas County area. And I know you got a lot more to do in the future. But I want you to kind of, looking over your bio, I want you to kind of tell everybody a little bit about who you are. And just tell us about your family and about yourself. Okay?
Absolutely. First and foremost, thank you so much for having me on this podcast. You know, this is an absolute honor, and I'm absolutely delighted to be in the midst of some amazing people who are listening today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, my name, Almas Muscatawala, and the name I already kind of explained, you know, it has amazing meaning. My last name, Muscatawala, also is very interesting. Muscat is the capital of Oman, and my in-laws, you know, actually came from Muscat. So that kind of whole lineage and heritage, you know, from Muscat also is kind of a very interesting one that I have inherited after I got married to my husband, Aziz Muscatawala. And then I have two boys, Naeem and Nabil. And mm-hmm. I was interestingly born, brought up, I was educated, I got married, I had both my boys, Naeem and Nabil, in India. And then, interestingly enough, we migrated to the U.S., Dallas, in 1998. And since then, we've lived in the U.S. And my family, from my mom's side and dad's side, is very, very interesting. And I say this because, you know, this has significantly influenced the way I do things in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So my mom came from a state in India, which is Hyderabad, you know, Andhra Pradesh. It's the name of the state is Andhra Pradesh, but the name of the place where she was growing up was Warangal, which is the south of India. And my dad came from Gujarat, which is a whole different another state, and he spoke Gujarati, which is a different language than my mom, who came from Hyderabad, who spoke Urdu.
Uh-huh.
And they both met in Mumbai, and of course got married. And, you know, I I was born and, you know, was had a very interesting life, you know, with this amazing parents. And my interestingly enough, I lived, you know, my most part of my life in Mumbai, and then kind of migrated to the US. And carrying all of these different backgrounds, multicultural background, has been very, very significant in my life, you know, because mm-hmm. I grew up speaking Gujarati, I grew up speaking Hindi. In school, I had to learn English and Marathi. And then, you know, obviously my boys learned, like my younger one learned Latin and my older one learned Spanish. And mm-hmm. and they grew up, you know, in America. And it's very interesting when all of these, you know, come together and really influence the way in which you think, you see others. And, you know, I think that's kind of very, very interesting. And as I mentioned, we've lived in the U.S. Since 1998. So we've been in the country for like close to, you know, 25 years. Mm-hmm. And we witnessed 9/11, Muslim ban, COVID, you know, you name it, mm-hmm. international war, and many significant events, you know, which kind of all of us, you know, who live in the U.S. and across the globe, some of the events are significantly influencing the way in which our cities, our states, and, you know, our countries affected. So it's been a very rich, you know, experience, you know, being part of India and then being part of America and then witnessing all these very significant events, you know, which indirectly influence, you know, our daily affairs, which without us recognizing, you know, but for me, I'm very conscious about how all of this is influencing. And, you know, obviously my family was very religious, grew up as a Shia Ismaili Muslim. Mm-hmm. Education was very important and service is very important. So grew up in all of this kind of dynamic, you know, and I brought that self, you know, to the U.S. and I bring that stuff to the community. So okay. That's kind of a brief little introduction.
Yeah, that's a lot of introduction. I'll tell you this one thing. I'm excited, I mean, to learn more about you and tonight to kind of get a let people know about your challenges as a volunteering in the community so much, and you're on several boards. And one of the things I want to tell everybody is that Alma's, it's one of my 2024 Living Legends, and I am so honored to have you. You were nominated by Rosie Strongberg, who was our Living Legend in 2022. And Rosie, every one of our Living Legends have a chance to nominate someone for the next year, next coming year.
Sure.
So, like this year, you will be able to nominate someone for 2025. So I'm just happy to have you as one of our Living Legends, and I want everybody to know we are giving all the Living Legends an opportunity to come on the podcast because it gives everybody more time and more time to talk with you as well as listen to you to learn about who you are. Just looking at your bio, you have done so much in the community. I wanted to just ask you, what was your most challenges that you had as a volunteer in the community?
I think one of the most, I must say that the choice of a volunteer, mm-hmm. it's a choice that I made in my life to serve as a volunteer, because if you look at my qualifications, I've done my undergraduate in psychology, my master's in child development. I could have easily gotten a job in any academic institution and, you know, pursued a career in that regard that made some money. But this is a choice that I made only because, as I was mentioning earlier, then, you know, my family really valued service, and the faith tradition that I come from also valued giving of your time and knowledge to the larger community is one of the core principles of the of the faith of Islam, and particularly for the faith of tradition that I belong to, which is the Shia Ismaili tradition. And it is ingrained in us, you know, to be able to offer our time and knowledge for the improvement and the quality of life of the larger community. So it's
right.
a choice that I made in my life that this is how I wanted to serve. And also, so what happens, one of the challenges that I feel that I encounter day in and day out is while, you know, being a volunteer gives you the flexibility of being able to offer your time and knowledge to any kind of issues, areas in which there is a need in the community or an area in which I have particular interest in which I can offer my services. But what mm-hmm. happens is that at the end of the day, it can be limiting because, you know, some of the structural, you know, systemic, you know, changes that one wants to see in the community requires, you know, sometimes it's kind of an influence that you need to have. And it's kind of hard to kind of play out all of those roles in just purely volunteer capacity. I mean, there's power to being able to kind of offer your time and knowledge in that regard, but sometimes it can also be limiting because there's only so much that you can do, right, in that capacity. So it's kind of been, you know, one of my areas in which I always struggle, that while I've chosen this kind of a life, you know, where I want to offer all of my services voluntarily, is there more that I can do, so just so that I can have a higher impact? And I think I remain in this space of, you know, continuing mm-hmm. to offer my services in a volunteer capacity, but also looking at alternate ways in which I can have a high impact. But as you know, that the work that I have done, you know, particularly my interest has been in the interfaith space, and also really particularly trying to bridge some of the divides or gaps that you see in the community between faith traditions and cultures. And so my goal has always been to kind of allow these traditions and faith to come together and see if there's a way in which we can collectively work together to impact, you know, some of the social issues that we see in our community. And to that point, I've been very, very fortunate that I was able to serve as a volunteer. Again, I started off as a very, very volunteer role in Thanksgiving Square as an interfaith council member, which led me to then kind of take on the role of chairing the interfaith council. And in that capacity, we were able to bring a lot of diverse faith traditions to present, you know, the cultural aspects of their faith. Sometimes when you look at the faith traditions, you almost always think about the theology, you know, the beliefs. And as we know, that the belief of one faith tradition are always going to be distinct from the other, you know, so that
right.
distinctness is going to remain, you know, a key characteristic, you know, of the faith tradition. But I think my goal was to see how we can bring that distinctness, you know, where every faith tradition can bring that distinctness and, you know, can still be in the same space and collectively go beyond their differences and see what are some of the ways in which they can serve the community collectively, because the power of collective effort is far larger than what an individual faith or an individual church or a mosque can do. And I think that has been some effort that I have put, you know, through the Interfaith Council of Thanksgiving Square, where, you know, I had done some work, you know, with the foundation to kind of see if there was a way in which we can kind of really have a nice impact in the community. And I think that also led me to create faith problem with that is because Interfaith Council kind of was more lay people, you know, coming together. But Faith Forward Dallas then was where the faith clergy, you know, or faith leaders or representative faith leaders was invited to then come together and see collectively how we can make a difference. And so it's been kind of interesting in that sense. Like personally, my capacity as a volunteer, what I can do, like these two initiatives can tell you that there's power to volunteer work. I mean, what can one person's desire to serve and offer their time and knowledge can do in one regard? But then when you actually get down to doing the work that we did, you know, through Faith Forward Dallas, and, you know, Faith Forward Dallas continues to do the work it does, you realize that there are other issues, you know, that you have to deal with, and which are far larger than my personal experience as a volunteer. And as you know, as Faith Forward Dallas, we dealt with issues of migration, we dealt with issues of gun violence, we dealt with the issues of homelessness, and also racial equity. So now when you look at those...
Was that Faith Forward Dallas, you said? What agency was that? What agency was that again, you said?
This is, again, all of this was done under the umbrella of Faith Forward Dallas, which operated under the auspices of Thanksgiving Square.
Thanksgiving Square, okay.
And, yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, Faith Forward Dallas brought, like, all the faith leaders together to look at these four areas. Obviously, we had to kind of narrow down our focus to these four areas in which we wanted to kind of really bring about the change. And so these were the four areas in which we focused on. And as you know, each of these areas, you know, look at the example of race, right? I mean, this is a generational, you know, we've been battling with race in America for generations, not just in America, but even globally, one could say that, you know, race has been an issue. But it is interesting, this is where I kind of want to kind of bring in a perspective as an Indian, that, you know, when I was growing up in India, race was not something that I was battling with. That was not one of the social issues that probably one would say as an Indian one had to deal with. You know, there's caste system, and there are other issues that we had to deal with as an Indian, you know. But when I came to the U.S., I had to learn, you know, from scratch the issues of racism through the interventions, you know, of my colleagues, you know, my faith leaders, and through the pilgrimage that we took as faith leaders, the civil rights pilgrimage, where we went to all the different places of civil rights that Martin Luther King kind of journeyed. And I had to kind of immerse myself into the issue of race to really then understand how deeply rooted this issue is and why we are, even in today, like 2024, we are still battling, you know, that issue in America. So, you know, it was an interesting journey in that regard, but the challenge is, you know, you sometimes feel like, are you really making a difference? Is it really making a dent, you know, in the work that you're doing? Because the issues are so deeply rooted, and it's been kind of, so many people have worked on it, right? And so it is interesting to see that, you know, you play a small little part in this big kind of space where these issues require all hands on deck, right? I mean, you can say that somebody else is working on race, so your kind of contribution is going to not be valuable. I guess from all different perspective, you know, this issue has to be dealt with. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, when you immerse yourself in these issues of, like, gun violence, you know, racism, I mean, look at the issue
domestic,
of homelessness.
And domestic violence,
affordable.
Too.
And domestic violence, oh, my gosh. Yeah. Like, You know, I serve as the chair of Texas Muslim Women's Foundation. I'm very, very blessed, you know, to be able to be part of this amazing organization where it's interesting to see how domestic violence can be detrimental to human life. And, you know, in the recent past, you know, years, what we've seen is that abuse is not just physical, it's not just emotional, it's not just compromising the dignity of the person who's getting abused, but in some cases, lives are lost. I mean, people, you know, are losing lives, so domestic violence really takes the form of actually, it is so intense, it gets like so intense in some cases, that the spouses or whoever is abused actually is murdered in those scenarios. Mm-hmm. And we've encountered some of those cases, you know, in very recent past. And so I think what now we are focusing on as an organization is that while we want to respond to that issue in its crisis mode, where after the fact, after the person is abused, they reach out to us and, you know, ask for services. We are also now committed to catch domestic violence in a proactive way where, you know, you catch it before, you know, after the fact. And so we're trying to kind of engage in a lot of preventive work where we talk about, you know, family harmony. We talk about how to resolve conflicts. We talk about, you know, so these are all preventive strategies that we're trying to apply so that two individuals or two families don't indulge into violence that can either compromise the dignity of the person or take the lives in some cases. How can you kind of really control that, right? How do you tackle that? Not always as the after-the-fact kind of scenario, but catch it before it happens. So we've committed ourselves, you know, this year in 2024 to really work on some kind of the preventive strategies, and we're keeping our fingers crossed, you know, to see if we can succeed in that. And so that space, again, is a very difficult space because, you know, once the person, and you know, it's typically when you think about domestic violence, you think about women, you know, being abused. But in our experience, we've seen men getting abused. We've seen elders getting abused. You know, we've seen young children getting abused. Like, I mean, if you have like a LGBTQ kid in your home and, you know, that kid can also get abused and would need shelter and services, you know, through our agency.
Right, right.
So absolutely that space is, again, pretty significant. And what I find very interesting is that domestic violence is directly, there's some kind of correlation between domestic violence and gun violence as well, because some of the abusers also use gun, you know, to abuse. You know, to threaten or, you know, emotionally threaten the abuser, you know, the abuser.
Right.
So there's also correlation with that. So, you know, this is another thing that I have realized, that one issue cannot be looked at it in an isolated way. Like, it has its impact. You know, you'll see its ripple effect in, like, many other areas, social issues, right? I mean, another example that you can look at it is like homelessness, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the immediate thing that, you know, there are a lot of things that one can try to unpack, you know, when one tries to define homelessness. But then affordable housing becomes, you know, another area in which you have to deal with, because to house a homeless, you need housing, and, you know, housing has to be affordable. And And so that's another area in which you find the correlation between two areas. You know, there's a whole agency that I'm part of, which is DHA, Dallas Housing Authority, that only deals with affordable housing for low-income people. But that entire effort is catering to low-income people who are able to pay minimum rent, right? I mean, the agency really takes care of, you know, the marginalized. You know, there's a lot of nice federal funding that we get through which we can support some of these low-income people. But then that area of work has a very small percentage of homeless people who get catered, you know, through that services. So there's a whole separate agency called Housing Forward, you know, which is a funding organization that works with service providers, you know, to address the issue of homelessness. So, so it's kind of interesting, you know, how one issue is, you know, correlated with the other, and you can never look at one issue in isolation and say, you know, so I'm always, and that's why you see me engaged in, like, many diverse things, like you see me in, like, Texas Muslim Women's Foundation addressing domestic violence, to DHA, where affordable housing is what I'm looking at, to interfaith work that I have done. And I see complete synergy in all of this work because I don't like to look at the issues in silos. And I feel like that can be the most dangerous thing one can do if one looks at one social issue in isolation, because it always has some kind of correlation to the other. And if you can look at everything holistically, then your strategies and the way you want to impact can be kind of very, very profound.
Okay.
I don't know. I like kind of said too many things, but I don't know if I responded to your...
Well, let me share something with you. Number one, we have people waiting online that may want to talk with you. I don't know. But if anybody who's... I do see you all there, and if you want to have... ask Almas a question, all you have to do is hit number one. When once you hit number one, I can see that you are in the audience and you do want to ask a question. So on your telephone, just press number one if you have a question for her. But meanwhile, Almas, I noticed that you have worked as a board of, on one of the board of directors for the Family Gateway. Also,
yes.
Project Unity, Dallas, the Holocaust, and Human Rights Museum.
Yes.
For instance, Family Gateway. My friend, her name was Annette Strauss, back in the 80s. I worked with her in organizing Family Gateway. And her daughters, one of them name was Nancy. I forgot the other one. She had two daughters back then. But she would always tell me sometimes how she was discriminated against. And I told her, I said, how are you being discriminated against? She said, well, some people don't like me neither, Verna, because I'm Jewish. And so I was asking her, well, why wouldn't they not like you? She said, because, she said, I'm treated sometimes. So me and her was very personal about how people treated different people because of the race or who they were.
And
Family Gateway means a lot to me because Family Gateway in Austin Street Shelter, my organization back in 1982 helped organize those two organizations. The Austin Street Shelter was organized by the mayor, Stark Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
But Annette Strauss at that time was mayor pro tem. And really and truly, it was Annette Strauss who sparked the fire under Stark Taylor to do that, because he was the mayor. And Dallas did not have a shelter for families at that time in 1982. And we had to house the first family at our organization. And Mrs. Strauss was on our board along with Stark Taylor's wife, and her name was Carolyn. Carolyn was a nurse back then, but she was Stark Taylor's wife. And she saw the need for us to help people with, especially families who was living on the streets. So I'm very close. I have a very close commitment when I talk about helping families in, like, Family Gateway, Austin Street Shelter. When you see people living in those shelters, what do you do as a board member? What are some of the things that you try to do or want to do to help those people possibly get into permanent housing? Since you're on the board of Dallas Housing Association, do you all work together with Family Gateway to help people like that?
So first and foremost, I want to say that both the organizations that you've mentioned, Family Gateway and Austin Streets, are incredible organizations. Mm-hmm. I feel Family Gateway is the only organization that serves families with children, homeless families with children. We are the only organization that accepts children without taking into consideration their caste, creed, or, you know, we don't ask for any kind of, you know, what gender that you come from, your gender orientation, nothing. And we're the only organization. So it's you know, these are exemplars, I feel, of how an organization should be working meticulously to address the issue of homelessness. And your experience of, you know, people that felt a little discriminated, I don't know how far back is that, but as I'm mentioning that, in this point in time, if you want to experience any of these organizations, they are inclusive. They're going to welcome you. Obviously, we follow our processes of intake and assessment. We also, Family Gateway is also incredible in their diversion program, where mm-hmm. where you don't necessarily want everyone to come to the shelter and avail our services. If there was a way for us to divert this person's, you know, situation, after assessing the situation, if there was a way for us to do diversion where the person doesn't have to, or family doesn't have to come to the shelter, we definitely take that as our first option, you know, of service that we want to offer. So while our shelter services work very in a very elaborate fashion, a diversion mm-hmm. program really works equally, you know, efficiently, because at the end of the day, people, when they get stuck and they don't know what to do, even that facilitation that we provide itself becomes very, very valuable to the family. Right. So absolutely, you know, incredible work happening at Family Gateway. Now, as mm-hmm. far as, you know, how the DHA, Dallas Housing Authority, and a Family Gateway, which is kind of purely working with homeless people. As I mentioned, the distinction between these two organizations is that DHA works, you know, provides affordable housing to low-income people. So they, when I say low-income people, you know, they're able to pitch in, you know, a minimum income, you know, they're able to pitch in insignificant amount, you know, it may be completely insignificant amount into their rent, you know, even if they're on the voucher program, whichever, you know, program they're on with DHA, you know, they have a job and they're able to kind of pay rent, and that becomes kind of the criteria. Now, that's a whole federally funded, you know, endeavor that DHA does. And as far as Family Gateway is concerned, again, they are also funded, you know, through Housing Forward and city funding, and, you know, multiple, you know, we get funding from many different agencies and cities, and, you know, state funding and all of that good stuff. And we're incredible in that regard. But as I mentioned, there's a very small quota of homeless people who will get served by DHA in a special program. Quota. But independently, Family Gateway and many other organizations like Austin Street, City Square, you know, I'm not able to name all of the service providers, like Stupart, you know, through the Presbyterian Church in Dallas, all of them get funded through Housing Forward, and their entire focus is to house homeless people. And that process, again, has like stages, as you were mentioning, you know, immediate, you know, transitional shelter to permanent housing to then eventually, you know, having the person become self-sufficient. I mean, I don't know if you saw the news, but, you know, just in the current bond that the city, you know, I think awarded for housing in the category of housing, I think it awarded, I'm not sure what the number was, but a pretty, I think more than 24, 25 million, you know, for in the category of housing. And now that will definitely get distributed between homelessness and affordable housing in that regard.
Right.
So it's a very dynamic, very multi-layered process. And, you know, the goal is honestly to get to the point where people become self-sufficient. And to me, self-sufficiency, self-reliance is a very key value that all organizations should incorporate, because at the end of the day, you do not want the person that you've served once to ever come back to you. You want that person to become self-sufficient so they're able to run their lives independently without any kind of intervention, right? And what happens is sometimes with the intent of providing the short-term interventions, people become conditioned to receive these services, you know, and self-sufficiency becomes like the next kind of priority, you know, which immediate need might be the shelter. So you provide that and, you know, you take care of the family. But self-sufficiency to me is very, very critical. And I think that's one of the core values of the Ismaili tradition that I come from. My spiritual leader, His Highness, has established a non-profit organization which is called Aga Khan Development Network. And basically that organization really reflects the social conscience of Islam. So if you wanted to see Islam in action, it's basically the Aga Khan Development Network is one of the examples, you know, of how, you know, the social conscience of Islam can be exemplified through that organization. And, you know, His Highness has created this parameters, you know, he's created this ethical framework on basis of which the entire Aga Khan Development Network operates. And one of the ethical, you know, in the ethical framework document, one of the values, one of the ethic is self-reliance. You know, which is basically you can teach someone, you know, you can give someone a fish for a day, but if you teach someone how to fish, then they'll be able to feed themselves, you know, for life. Now, that sounds like very cliche. You've heard it many times, but to really incorporate that value into everything that you do as a nonprofit organization, as a service provider, becomes very, very hard. Because at the end of the day, you want to be able to provide your services in a sustainable way. And if you're not able to sustain the quality of life of which you kind of started off, then you it's not sustainable. That system cannot be sustainable. You'll run out of resources because more and more people, you know, need services, you know, with the kind of economic
Almos, let me ask you something. What type programs? I don't know if you all have them existing now, either with the Family Place or Austin Street Shed. What type of programs, or even with the Dallas Housing Association, that you have to teach these people how to be self-sufficient? Is there any programs to date? I mean, that's actually there.
Yeah, absolutely, this value is incorporated in DHA and Family Gateway's operation, like you know, it's definitely incorporated, but I don't think there's a separate program. Like, I mean, look at DHA, right? I mean, Dallas Housing Authority provides affordable housing to low-income people, and the commitment is, for whatever time frame the commitment is made, you know, to the family. What I would like to see, and I don't think, you know, currently, even if it is possible in the vision of DHA or even HUD that provides us the funding, to see that while we pitch in for the rent, you know, or through the voucher program in someone's life, you pitch in the rent for this particular family. If there were interventions provided to see if this person's monthly income can be raised so that this person can have mobility to move into areas where it's not like a cluster of all low-income family in one particular area, right? I mean, you also want to see progress in their life, where their life is not where it was, you know, 2 years ago. You want to see the progress. So you see some of the families who are very motivated or who avail some of the services that are provided by the city and DHA and Family Gateway would incorporate those services. But mostly, you know, you will see people, their lives remaining status quo, right? And that's the kind of change that I am aspiring in some fashion to see happen. So there are no specific programs that I can list, but, you know, we provide skills, right? We provide counseling, we provide interventions, you know, job, you know, finding. DHA doesn't do that, but, you know, Family Gateway is like full-fledged, right? I mean, we provide the daycare, we provide, you know, intervention for the children as well. So in that sense, we're looking after the entire family. We're not just providing the shelter. There's more that is done. But having said that, what are some of the ways in which we can kind of take the person's family income from one economic strata to the next level? But that requires, you know, some more, you know, more work. We won't be able to serve more families. You know, we would have to devote to less number of people and kind of moving them to the next level of economic strata, right, and making them self-sufficient and then serving the next set of people. Now, that cycle doesn't work. You know, you're never able to kind of say that I'm only going to focus on this many people and just kind of improve. That would be like a case study that one would have to do, right, to see how we can make it sustainable in someone's life. Sorry.
I see.
I gave you a long answer.
Yeah, but it's good. It was a good answer because it makes me know that some of these people that you are helping actually needs training. They actually need somebody to actually teach them how to become self-sufficient, how to make, you know, in other words, if a person, I tell people all the time, when we used to have people coming in from prison, and they would be, they learn in prison how to do hair, cut hair, how to even run laundromats. Okay, so if they know all of that, if they were taught that in prison, or they learn all of that in prison, when they come home, then they're homeless. But if you know, have any kind of skill, you can all, I mean, I try to pull that skill out of their mind, you know, in their mindset, and make sure that they want to continue that. In other words, if a person know how to run all those big machines in the prison, how to clean uniforms, press uniforms, they could open up their own cleaners. They can have their own cleaners.
And education becomes fundamental. Like, I feel like if we were to, in fact, you know, World Bank, you know, the definition, you know, at the end of the day, all of this is also tied to economic standing, and economic standing basically implies, you know, poverty. But if you look at poverty purely from the income standpoint, it's a very limiting definition that you're looking at it. Like, you know, when you want to eradicate poverty, you have to look at, you know, the living condition. You have to look at housing. You have to look at access to healthcare. You have to look at access to education. Like, all of that intervention mm-hmm. then allows, you know, the person to say that, you know, you're giving them tools of education, you're giving them skills, you know, so that they're able to bank on that skills to be able to generate revenue or income in their life, you know, to then kind of improve, right? So if you were to look at just housing, you know, independently, it can do its kind of, it can provide the service that it set out to provide, but I feel like can it really sustain, can this person or family not encounter another hurdle mm-hmm. in the near future or in the long term if they were given more skills in that toolbox, you know, to kind of bank on, mm-hmm. to be able to say that now I have control on my life, right? I don't need this other institution to intervene in my life to pay my rent. And that is the cycle, you know, that you want to break so that because it's just humanly not possible to keep providing services from just one, you know, one right. just purely from housing, right? I mean, it needs, I mean, your mental health, right? I mean, so many things that you have to take into account. So of course, you know, all of these service providers, you know, take that into account, but you know, they all focus on you know, their primary mandate of, say, providing housing to homeless people or providing affordable housing to low-income people, you know. So they focus on that, but there are other areas that need attention unless the other institutions are providing that intervention in their life. Only then I feel like that family would be able to sustain himself, herself as a family, you know, in the future.
Right,
and
right.
And think about, we're not even taking into account, like, these are all the people that we're accounted in our census, you know. But what about the migrants, the immigrants, you know, the significant number of migrants who come to our city, you know, and they need the same resources and interventions. And they don't even get accounted in our census until, you know, they've cleared, you know, all their or their formalities, you know, through the court and everything. So they reach out to these same institutions, you know, for services. So somewhere, we all have to sit back and, like, look at it holistically, what we can do as a society or as a city, as a community, as a neighborhood, as faith leaders. And I really find the power in, you know, what faith leaders can do, and that's why my heart is, you know, with the faith leaders and faith communities that very, because they're rooted, it's rooted in their faith to offer that services. Imagine if we were to institutionalize their services in such a fashion that they can supplement the work that is done by some of these, you know, nonprofits and service providers. Like, mm-hmm. it can all then collectively, you know, work towards that same goal.
Right, right. Well, I tell you, you're a very interesting person. You've got a lot of things. You've done a lot of things. And just learning about all of the – and you actually volunteer on all of these boards? This is a lot of boards,
yes,
that
I
you
do.
Work with.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah, and – sorry, go ahead.
What is your effort? What type of efforts would you be working on in the future?
What
kind of efforts do you – will you be working on in the future? You know, I mean, on this year and next year, will you be working still with the where you are now, or will you be enhancing what you're doing?
So I, you know, I do have to take an inventory of, you know, prioritizing some of the things that I'm doing. Definitely,
mm-hmm.
Definitely this year I'll continue being the chair, I'll continue being on DHA and Project Unity. I completely love, you know, Project Unity is, again, a very interesting organization. And what I like about Project Unity is that we address the issue of race through dialogue. You know, we do this Together We Dine, model where we bring a group of people together and we probe them to think about the biases and the stereotypes that they may be carrying in their life by breaking a bread together, you know, a small group of people engaging in a dialogue. And it's all facilitated. And I find that model quite, you know, interesting and powerful because, you know, sometimes when race is talked about, we all seem to think that I am not racist, somebody else is. I don't carry these biases, somebody else does. So, you know, we look at race as like something that, you know, we never kind of assess our own kind of biases and stereotypes. And what these Together We Dine does is like probes you to think about, you know, your own biases in relation to the other. And you know, all these biases kind of operate at a subconscious level. So sometimes you're not even conscious about it. So these Together We Dine conversation bring those biases from the subconscious to your conscious in the forefront. And it allows you to kind of look at, you know, the other in a slightly different way. So I'm very excited about my continuing, you know, role in Project Unity and some of the other organizations that I'm part of. But I do want to, you know, pause and see where I think my most needed and where I can offer my best services and where I can have high impact. I have, you know, some aspirations to go back to school and add some kind of more knowledge base and skill sets, you know, to my own way the way I conduct my volunteer work and see if there is a way I can refine myself further so I can offer myself better to the community. So I'm constantly looking to improve myself so that I can be more kind of available, you know, for the services of the larger community. So that's one area that I'm looking at, you know, constantly kind of prioritizing, you know, in the areas in which I want to really focus. And then secondly, to keep refining myself so I can be of better service, you know, to others. And those are the two areas in which, you know, I see myself. But individually, I love all the different, you know, organizations that I'm part of. And in fact, one of the things that I would like to announce for anybody who's listening at this point, that I used to, initiated this program called Faith in Conversation, which was hosted under the auspices of Thanksgiving Square. But the same conversations are now going to be hosted through University of Texas in Dallas. And our first session for this new, through UTD is going to be on March 8th. March 7th. And it's at 6:30 in the evening, and it's in the performance hall at UTD. And the topic that we're going to cover is sacred spaces in Islam. So it's a series of conversations that we're going to do. We're starting off with Islam, but next conversation will be sacred spaces in Buddhism, in Judaism, in Christianity, in Hinduism. And, you know, we'll have like a nice set of six kind of conversations just so that we can understand the importance of sacredness, you know, that Muslims in this regard, you know, the first session attach to their spaces, you know, how important spaces in the faith of Islam. So that's kind of something that's coming up as well, which I'm very excited about.
Well, listen, I have some questions coming in. We have a panel. You have some questions from some of our listeners who want to ask you, what are you all doing on the Dallas Mayor's Advisory Council, Hate Advisory Council? What do y'all do there? You have one more question, and there's another question also. What is the difference in a commissioner? What is a commissioner's obligation, or what is their job? What do they do with DHA? What's the difference in a member and a commissioner, I guess?
Okay, interesting. Now that's the title, because I think the way I understand this role is that this is kind of carved out by HUD, which is the funding organ, federal funding organization. That this is a structure in which the commissioner is the title that is given. Essentially, it is a board member's role. I wouldn't characterize it any differently than a board, but it's only a five commissioners board. There are only five commissioners. And okay. And interestingly enough, the role that we have as a commissioner is to be basically participating in some of the policies that come out of DHA. So that's kind of one role that we contribute our expertise and our knowledge and our understanding on the basis of our grassroots realities and also, you know, so on policy, that's kind of one area in which we have to contribute. And secondly, we are the custodians of the funding that we receive. So we want to be very, very intentional and strategic. The commissioners really contribute in discussing how the funds that we receive from HUD needs to be distributed. I mean, some, you know, funds are definitely defined in how they need to be used, but we become custodians of it. So which means it's not about just how the funds are going to be used, but are the customers, are the clients, are the people who are receiving the services also happy with the way the funds were distributed, not in terms of like actually receiving the funds, but in the way we are taking care of them through our services. So mm-hmm. we are the custodians in that sense, and we are policymakers. So those are the two roles as DHA. And as far as the Dallas Mayor's Anti-Hate Advisory Council is concerned, you know, we serve as the advisor to the mayor of Dallas. As you know, hate is so prevalent, and more so now after the war, which is, you know, currently happening in Middle East, in between, you know, Palestine and Israel. I think so. Our job as the council is to provide, you know, as an advisory board, we provide consultation, you know, to the mayor on some of the efforts that he could take with regards to not just addressing hate, but eradicating probably hate from the community. And so the mayor of Dallas formulated this advisory council, I think, 2 years ago. And we've been, I think, a little over 2 years. This is the third year now. And basically, yeah, we're the advisors. And we're not a programming body, so we don't see a lot of programming come out of our advisory committee, but it is more more kind of consolidating some of the work that the others are doing and providing some of the best practices, you know, to the mayor to see, you know, examples mm-hmm. of what can be done, you know, to address. It's more like an advisory role.
Okay, I see. To help him with his efforts of making a difference in things.
Yeah. And you never know. You can never quantify. And there's always more to be done. I'm just somebody who's never, ever felt that I can look back and say, this is enough. I always want to do more. I always push, you know, the advisory council, whichever board committees that I work, I want to do more, and I want them to do more so that more can be done, and, you know, we can serve more people and, you know, be better in providing our services. So there's always room for doing more. I wouldn't say that in any way any of these, you know, institutions are complete, or, you know, there's always areas in which, you know, we can do better.
I see. Okay. Well, that's only two questions that I see coming in from outside, but I would like to ask also about your religion. It compares with the Jewish, the Muslims, and India. What do you all have in common are to, I mean, you know, you're very, you know, you're very close, and you all is very, you all do a lot of things together. So can you explain more about your faith or your religion as well as with the Muslims as well and the Jewish community?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm a Muslim. I'm a Shia Ismaili Muslim. We are the second largest interpretation as you know, that in Islam there are two branches, the Shias and the Sunnis. Mm-hmm. The Sunnis make up the majority and the Shias are minority. But within the Shia branch of Islam, we are Shia Ismailis are the second largest Shia interpretation of the Shia branch of Islam. And we have a present living Imam, His Highness the Aga Khan, who is the 49th hereditary Imam, who is a direct descendant of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So he's our spiritual leader. And his role as the Imam, and we are almost close to, you know, 15 million Ismaili Muslims, the same number of Jews in the world. And the role of the Imam in the Shia Ismaili tradition is to guide the community on the matters of faith. So we kind of receive our guidance from our Imam on how to conduct ourselves and how to live our lives. He's also responsible to improve the quality of our lives. So he interprets the faith of Islam for us. So he guides us according to the time. And then he's responsible for improving our quality of life. So pretty much, some of the key areas in which he's guided us and which becomes like my guiding parameter in everything that I do is he's big about, embracing the diversity as a reality, as a strength. And then he's also introduced and he's established, as I mentioned earlier, the Aga Khan Development Network, which is an agency that basically works in Asia and Africa to respond to almost eradicating poverty from the community. And as I mentioned, that his definition of poverty is not just income-based, but it's holistic. So that's kind of one organization. And he's also established Center for Pluralism in Ottawa, Canada, which really, this pluralism is an idea which his guidance is that it's a learned behavior. Diversity is the reality of our life. We're born different. You cannot do anything about it. You've been born different. But pluralism is where he says, you learn to coexist with the other who's different from you in a harmonious way. And that pluralism really calls for you to get to know the other in such a fashion. And you get to the point that pluralism means you accept the other with their differences. You learn to accept that difference and you learn to coexist harmoniously. And in that understanding and acceptance, you develop a bond in such a fashion that you start to hurt when the other hurts.
Yes.
And that he calls cosmopolitan ethic. This is kind of one idea. So, when you think about faith tradition, he guides us on how we are supposed to pray in the four walls of our Jamaat Khana, which is a place of worship. But then in Islam, there's no dichotomy between faith and the secular. Your religious life and your spiritual life is intertwined with your secular life. So what you do in your secular life is part of your faith. And so pluralism is one of the values he wants us to incorporate in our life so that we can serve, others better.
And so that's the guy that's called the Aman. You say you all call him Aman?
Imam. This Imam of the Shia Ismaili tradition is different than the Imam, that you you meet in the Sunni tradition or in the other mosque, imam is...
Amos, yes. We have some people that want to ask you some questions. Do you think I need to bring them on? I mean, let me, because I don't want them to think that we're ignoring them. So I want to bring on at least one. Let me get this one here. Okay.
Okay.
Yes. Hello. You're on the air. Go ahead. Hello. Hello. 1401 with the telephone number ending with 1401. You're on the air. Go ahead. Okay, I think maybe they may have changed their mind.
Yeah. Can pass on my email, or they can look me up on LinkedIn, on Facebook. I'm not very active on Instagram, but LinkedIn for sure. And I can take the question probably, you know, from LinkedIn as well.
Okay, well, whoever this was, they're not saying anything right now. So, but nevertheless, so there's a difference in iman and the Jewish leader. Do they have an iman as well?
No, so they have a rabbi. You know, they have a rabbi, and in Christianity they have a pastor. Yeah, so it's a rabbi, you know, a pastor. And then in Shia tradition, it's the imam, and the imam in the mosque, the imam that you meet in a mosque, each mosque has a different imam, and they are the scholars, and they are the custodians of that particular mosque. They are the scholar, in-house scholar, who lead the prayer and who are responsible, you know, for that particular mosque. But the notion of imam, or the concept of imam in the Shia Ismaili tradition, is that he has a spiritual lineage, you know, from the progeny of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, who is the prophet of Islam. So for the Shia Ismaili tradition, he's one imam. We have only one imam for the 15 million Ismaili Muslims. He's one authority that guides us, the entire community. So each place of worship that we have across the globe for the Ismaili tradition, our place of worship is called Jamaat Khana. Jamaat Khana is a Persian word meaning house of prayer. It's also a community place of worship for us. So this notion of authority in the Shia tradition is a different authority than the imam that you meet in the mosque. And as I said, that His Highness is, you know, the first imam, you know, who was appointed in Ghadir-e Khum. This is the place, you know, where our Prophet received a revelation to declare Hazrat Ali as the first imam. And since then, the lineage of that imamat is in the present 49th imam. So in the Shia tradition, the imam is guiding the community according to the time. And that's why he's called Hazar Imam. And Hazar means present imam, who guides us according to the time. As you know, the time changes, and you know he guides us according to the time, and that authority is spiritual, and you know he guides us in the matters of faith and the world, and so his guidance is what Ismaili tradition, the faith tradition that I belong to, we follow, and we also follow the Prophet of Islam. And his teachings, which are called hadith, and we also, reflect and contemplate on the verses of the Quran, which are part of our prayer as well. And so And even the curriculum that we teach, you know, in our religious education centers, the approach that we take is very civilizational approach, where constantly the children are learning not just about Islam as a civilization, but Islam is a civilization in relation to other civilizations that were existing when Islam was, you know, spreading or flourishing. So children are constantly learning about the other, about pluralism, right? You know, when at a very young age. So these are some of the values, right?
Right.
You know, His Highness has established academies. There are universities: Aga Khan University, Aga Khan University of Central Asia, in the most mountainous area in Tajikistan. He's got a state-of-the-art university established. So education is very important, because the role of intellect in Islam is very, very important. Islam is a thinking faith, His Highness talks about, and he says that you have to engage with your faith intellectually, emotionally, socially. So it's a very interesting way in which we're guided, so that we see the other in relation to ourselves. We see the, you know, in fact, one of the things that he says, and it's a verse of the Quran that, you know, in which Allah says that we've all been created from a single soul, right? His Highness talks about that. And if our commonality is that we've all been created from a single soul, then the idea of us as spiritual brothers and sisters become natural. You know, every person that you meet is a brother in humanity or brother in spirituality, because, you know, we've all been created from a single soul. So these ideas seem kind of very, probably might sound, you know, something very ambitious, but in the Shia Ismaili tradition, we are guided to kind of live it in our daily affairs. And that's one of the ways you express your faith. In fact, you know, so it's interesting. And then even the education, the purpose of education in the Shia Ismaili tradition is not just to be able to provide a living for your family, but you educate yourself so that you can understand God's creation. And also that if you're educated, you are able to offer, you know, you're supposed to offer that education in the service of others. And in that regard, you know, His Highness has established a program called Time and Knowledge Nazrana. And that Nazrana means offering. So Time and Knowledge Offering is an initiative that he established when he completed his 50 years of imamah. And in that, basically what you're invited to do is offer your time and knowledge, you know, to your brothers and sisters, Ismaili brothers and sisters globally. So some of these people who offer these time and knowledge really put a stop to their life, put a full stop to their life, you know, in their existing life, and they offer, they go for a year. They could say that I want to give off my 1 year in Tajikistan or in Africa or in Kenya or in Uganda or in India. Some people come, you know, wherever they are, you know, they get transferred. And they offer their time and knowledge. They don't get paid. So this, when and it kind of comes full circle to me and our conversation today, that me choosing a life of volunteers really rooted in this idea that I'm being guided by His Highness the Aga Khan to offer my services. So, you know, some people offer their time and knowledge, Nazrana, you know, within the Ismaili Muslim community and for the larger community. I've chosen, you know, to offer generously just for my entire life, you know, voluntarily.
Well, Almas, you got one more question coming in too. I can't get your questions in on my email, which comes in to us for our guest, and you have one more question. And this person is asking, what advice would you give to a young activist wanting to learn more about the different agencies in Dallas?
I guess they probably mean advocate.
What advice would you give to a young advocate wanting to learn more about the different agencies?
I think advocacy is very essential, very necessary, because for me, advocacy is basically you're advocating for a group of people who don't have a voice, you know, for themselves, and you become the voice for them. So you're advocating, you know, on their behalf. And advocacy to me is also education, you know. When you're educating, sometimes people are ignorant about this group of people. They just don't know that this marginalized group is existing and these are their issues. And so if you're advocating on their behalf, you're really taking on the responsibility of educating the community about the issues of these marginalized groups. So I think for my advice to whoever's asking this question is that first you need to find what are some of the areas, you know, what keeps you up? What makes you uncomfortable? What are some of the social issues that keeps you up in the night? And once you've identified those, then it is important for you to engage in that area, the social issue, whatever that issue is. Engage yourself not just advocating for them by showing activism, because you know sometimes people interchangeably think of activism and advocacy as the same idea. Sometimes advocacy, you know, takes the form of activism, but I would advise, you know, people to kind of lobby for some of these issues at your city level, at the state level, at the federal level. Organize, you know, groups, you know, create your allies, you know, who can support, you know, this advocacy work. And there are a lot of existing organizations that are already probably doing the area in which you have interest, you know, in advocacy. Identify, look for those, you know, organizations and, you know, sign up, you know, to work, you know, and participate in these organizations so that your voice can be added to those existing voices and it can enhance further, you know, the advocacy work that is needed. But, you know, it is very important the advocates keep track of the legislation, the state legislation that happen every 2 years to see, keep track of, you know, what are some of the policies, because policy is very important. You know, while we offer services, some of the examples that we discussed today, these are direct services that we are providing through Family Gateway, through DHA, through Project Unity. But there are other organizations that are doing a lot of advocacy work, which means they're negotiating for better policies for these marginalized groups, you know, that we were talking about today who are getting services. So that's kind of one advice that I have.
Okay, then we're running behind schedule here. It's after 8 o'clock, but we're still on the air, but I wanted to let you. I did promise you that we would be here only an hour, and we're running over. But I want you to tell people again if they want to contact you. Should we contact you on Linkage? How would they contact you?
So my email is really long, so I'm not going to put that out. But you can look me up on LinkedIn on my first name and last name, Almaz Maskatwala. You can also look me up on Facebook. I'm also on Instagram. These are the three social media platforms you can find me. And I'll be more than happy and willing to engage with you further on some of the things that we've talked today.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I want to thank you, Almaz, also for accepting to be one of our living legends for 2024.
Thank you.
We look forward to seeing you there. And your family, we want you to invite your family members too as well, and invite anybody and all people that you want to invite. We have we're hoping that we can pack the room out this year. So I'm looking forward to talking with you again. And I want to thank everybody for calling in, those who sent text messages, those who sent email messages. I want to thank you all for listening to Metroplex Buzz. And what we're trying to do is to keep the community informed and with our leaders of all faith, all races. And so we just thank you for being our guest tonight, and thank you for listening. All right, and Elmer, we're going to have to stop for right now because we do have to get off the air. I did not know it was a mistake. They told me that it's a little bit, I mean, it's past 8, but everybody online is still there. Listen online.
Thank you.
If you ever want to come back on again, Elmer, just let me know. We're more than happy to have you back on again. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us, darling. Have a good evening. We want to thank everybody. Good night and have a blessed day. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay? All right.